Welcome to episode 303 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I'm your host, Ian Martin, and today we're going to be finding out about the ski resorts of Isla 2000, which I visited recently, combined with a city break in Nice, as well as a Swedish ski resort of Stutten. We're also going to hear about a new project to improve outdoor clothing for disabled people, and we'll hear how the recent SIGB ski test went with our equipment expert, Al Morgan. Add in our regular snow reports, an Olympic catch-up, and your feedback, and that's today's show. But before we meet today's guests, I'd like to thank Tyrol for sponsoring the Ski Podcast and making this winter's episodes possible. If this is your first time listening, I strongly recommend you catch up with some of the great conversations we've had about Tyrol this winter. Whether you want to know about Innsbruck or Ischgl, the Ski Veldt or Surfhaus, and plenty more in between, it's all in our back catalogue to catch up with. I've really enjoyed this series of episodes and finding out more about an area I thought I knew pretty well already. But let's meet today's guests. My first guest joins me for her first time on the show. It is Unparalleled founder, Alice Sainsbury. Hi, Alice. How are you?
Hi. Yeah, really good. Thank you. Yeah, great to be here.
Oh, whereabouts are you today?
So I'm currently in Cornwall in the UK, and then later on today, I'll be back up in London.
Oh, and shortly, as we'll discuss later, you'll be on your way to the Paralympics out in Italy. So we'll discuss that more in due course. It's a second appearance on the show for today's other guest. He was last with us in episode 221, discussing skiing in Sweden. There was so much to cover. I've asked him back to join us again. Welcome to Ben Nyberg, Managing Director at Ski Scandinavia. Hi, Ben. How are you?
Hi, Ian. Yes, very good. Thank you. Thank you for having me back on the show again.
Oh, and whereabouts are you today?
Today, I am in the ski resort of Stutten in Sweden.
Okay, was my pronunciation correct then, or close to being correct?
It was close. It was very close. It was a good effort.
Excellent. And how's the snow looking out of the window? Can you actually see it out of the window where you are?
I can indeed. Absolutely incredible. It's pristine snow conditions, bright blue skies and sunshine. It's probably the best day to be out skiing so far this season, I think.
Okay, well, we won't hold you up too long then. But a question I always like to start off with my guests, is to ask you when you skied or snowboarded last. And for you, Alice, when was that?
That was probably about 3 weeks ago in Courchevel. We were doing some testing for the Unparalleled project. And since my spinal cord injury, I actually hadn't tried skiing. I'd tried cross-country skiing, but not skiing. So this was my first time trying adaptive skiing. Which was really exciting, and first time on a sit ski as well. So yeah, it was amazing.
Right. Okay. I'm interested to talk more about that. I think in France, they often refer to it as handy ski. And I think Courchevel is one of those resorts that maybe specializes in it. They have a lot of lifts that are suitable for handy skis. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say because they've got more bubble lifts, it's easier to get a sit ski in. It takes a bit of oomph and a lot of physical power to get them in the lifts. But yeah, I mean, the staff there are amazing at slowing the lifts down, ushering us forward, making sure that no one's trying to skip the queue and push in front of us when we're trying to get a sit ski in. So yeah, pretty good.
And if you went 3 weeks ago, I'm guessing then that you arrived in between the massive snowstorms that are going on. So maybe you had good snow and nice weather.
Yeah, we had that really beautiful, crisp, but very icy without snow at the beginning of the week, which was fantastic for filming because we were also filming. It was the last couple of days that dump started coming in, and it was just, yeah, amazing. But a whiteout.
Yeah. And Ben, what about yourself? You're living in a ski resort. You're on a ski resort right now. So was it yesterday when you were last on snow?
Absolutely. It was yesterday indeed. We ventured over the Norwegian border, actually, to Trysil in Norway for a day of skiing. So, yeah, literally on my skis yesterday.
Oh, and what were conditions like in Trysil?
Fantastic. Same again, blue skies and sunshine. It actually snowed the night before, so it was fresh powder, some good off-piste, great on-piste, and yeah, just absolutely fantastic.
Well, I guess, listener, you're probably aware that it has been snowing very heavily in the Alps at the moment. Unfortunately, there have been a number of fatalities. The avalanche danger is very high. But let's listen to some snow reports from some of our regular contributors. We have Tim Hudson from Inspired Italy in the Dolomites, Jen Sang from That's La Plan in La Plan, and Andy Butterworth from Kalumaski in St Anton.
Buonasera, Ian. Tim Hudson from Inspired Italy, reporting in from the Val Gardena in the Italian Olympic Dolomites. I've been out skiing all day with some clients, and I can tell you that it has been a bluebird day. Well, maybe with the exception of the last 40, 45 minutes. I'll tell you more about that in a moment. The slopes are in fantastic condition. A great solid base with a little bit of loose stuff on the top. So just absolutely perfect. And relatively speaking, given that this should be the busiest week of the year, things are really quiet. And that is the Olympic effect. What seems to have happened is that people have judged that the Olympics would make the area super busy, which, of course, in the Val Gardena is not the case, because the Olympics are in Cortina, some 20 odd miles away. Although there are areas like Predazzo that are also affected. But, you know, essentially, yep, people have decided that the Dolomites was not the place to go skiing during the Olympic period. So good for you if you're here and you are coming. And even better news is that starting at about 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, we are expecting somewhere between 20 and 40 centimetres of fresh snow over that 24-hour period. And the following day is looking like bluebird days as well. A little bit warmer than it's been, but all setting up for a fantastic end to the season. Tim Hudson signing out from the Dolomites. Ciao.
Hi, Ian and the Ski Podcast. It is great to be coming to you again live from the slopes of La Plan. This is Jen from That's La Plan, and I'm here to tell you about the snow conditions in resort currently. And I mean, wowee, I really just do not know where to start. It has been an absolutely incredible 10 days of snow, to the extent where last week we had so much snow and so many strong winds, high winds in the resort, that we had the unprecedented decision made to actually shut the resort on Thursday last week. I've been here a long, long time, and I've not seen the resort take that decision in advance of a day to actually shut the lifts. But the winds were incredibly high. The avalanche risk hit 5 out of 5. And with the amount of avalanche related deaths that have been across the Alps this winter, it seemed like a very sensible decision. We saw the lifts opening slowly on Friday morning, and then throughout the rest of the time since then, we have had the lifts open and running. However, we've had incredible amounts of snow falling, so easily over a metre of snow at plan centre level, which is about 2,000 metres, and much, much higher up high. We haven't seen the glacier open, which is up at 3,000 metres, because the snow hasn't stopped to stabilise the area. So I'm very excited to see that open up, hopefully towards the end of this week. I am sat here on the side of a slope in some beautiful sunshine right now, and this is our calm in between yesterday's storm and snow coming in again tonight and tomorrow. So it has been a very exciting few days. Like I said, avalanche risk is still 4 out of 5. The snow conditions are incredible. There's knee-deep powder just on the sides of the slopes where I am right now, and it is just fantastic. It is busy because it's probably half term, but there's so much snow and there's so much fun to be had. So this has been Jen, hot from the slopes in La Plan. Take care, and I'll see you on the slopes soon.
Hi everyone. Hi Ian. This is Andy over in St Anton. A very, very snowy St Anton in the middle of February, in the busiest week of the season. And thank God we've got the snow. We didn't really have such a big snowfall for a long, long time, certainly not in over a 48-hour period, where it was probably knee-deep in resort. The higher areas in resort, sort of like knee-deep, 40, 50 centimetres of snow, was quite amazing. That's pushed our snowfall up on the mountain, on top of Galtzig, which is about just over 2,000 metres, to 182 centimetres, which meaning the top of Valuga is way over 2 metres now. The snowfall has been tremendous. It's been proper alpine winter storms. It's been great to see. And given that the Austrian Alps certainly hasn't really had much snowfall since the start of December, we've had coverings through January, but nothing like this. This is the first real mega dump of the season. So everyone in resort is buzzing. Resort is also very busy, but with this amount of snow and the high winds and the storm, it's meant that a lot of the lifts have been closed for a couple of days now. But with the weather warming up slightly, the avalanche danger has been a little bit high. So off the piste hasn't been great, but on the piste is incredible skiing. And that is lovely now, pretty much set the Arlberg region for the rest of the winter. So Looking ahead, the forecast is cold. It's staying cold. It's in the minus 10, 12s at night and the minus 6, 7s in the daytime. So that's really great for the snow conditions, pushing on into March and certainly into Easter. If you haven't booked your holiday yet, book your holidays now because the snow conditions are absolutely epic.
If you're a regular listener to the podcast, you will know that Emily Sarsfield, who competed for Team GB at the ski across in Pyeongchang, and I have been working hard. We have already published 8 Winter Olympics specials. Episodes. They include interviews with loads of the athletes and commentators, including our gold medal winners, Hugh Nightingale and Charlotte Banks, but also Shemi Alcott, Graham Bell, Ed Lee, Eddie the Eagle, and plenty more. All of those episodes are between 10 and 20 minutes long. So if you'd like to catch up, you're very welcome. I'm going to include a very small clip just now as a tribute to Britain's greatest slalom racer, Dave Riding, who skied for Team GB for the last time in Bormio on Monday. He leaves behind an amazing legacy, which I think he sums up really well in this short clip.
I will never stay the most successful British skier. I'll guarantee you that. And the next generation are ridiculously good, but I will always be the first one to get the win. And so I'm really proud of what I've been able to sort of push the bar to in British skiing. And then I can leave it to the next generation to take it further.
If you'd like to know more about Dave, I suggest you listen to episode 199. We still have 2 more episodes of the Winter Olympic specials to come on Friday and then wrapping up with our final episode on Sunday. So make sure you subscribe now so you don't miss those. Now, if you've been listening to those special episodes or following me on social media, you'll know that last week I took the night train from Paris to Nice, spent a day in Nice, and then went up to the ski resort of Isola 2000. I'm going to be writing up the trip for an article for The Telegraph, but I do want to mention it now as well, because it was such a great trip, and it's one that I would highly recommend. You obviously don't have to take the train, but regular listeners will know that I have taken the Flight Free UK pledge for the last couple of years. If you'd like to know more about that journey itself, I've written it up on Ski Flight Free, and I'll put a link in the show notes. As far as the journey goes, I know the night train isn't for everyone. Some people don't want to share a couchette, or they're worried if they're going to sleep okay. That was actually my 10th night train in the last 3 years, so I guess I'm getting used to it now. But the Paris-Nice train is a special one. It's my 3rd trip on this route, and it's so worth it for the views along the Côte d'Azur in the morning. Anyway, you don't have to take the train. You can get off your flight, travel from right next to the airport to Isola on the 100% Nej direct bus. But I strongly recommend you spend some time in Nice. You know, I guess it depends what you're looking for, but to me, Nice is such a great city to visit, especially in winter. It's compact enough that you can go everywhere on foot. You've got an amazing cuisine Niçoise, the best of French cooking with an Italian influence, markets, art museums, and most importantly, for Brits starved of vitamin D in winter, it's warm and sunny. Now, there's a long historical connection between the British and Nice, so I spoke to Caterina Prosciillo from the Nice Tourist Office to give me some context to that history. So I'm here just now with Caterina Prosciillo from the Nice Tourist Board. I wanted to say thank you so much for showing me around the city. I found it really interesting to find out much more about the long British connection with the city, because the first tourists really who came here were from Britain.
Yes, exactly. And yes, it's true. We have a very great connection with the British, because the first tourists came here to spend the winter. It was a British aristocracy.
Cool. So the British first started coming here as a stop on their way to doing the Grand Tour in Italy, when they're going to see all the cultural sites. They discovered that this was a good place to stop on the way.
Yeah, it's true. They first, like the young gentlemen, they were starting their tour in direction of Italy. Little by little, actually, there was a very a gentleman called Smollett that came here to spend the winter. And he started writing many letters to his peers. He wrote that the landscape was fantastic, the city beautiful for the winter, was always sunny, and you have the hills and the sea, so it was a great place to live here.
Yeah, well, he was right about the climate, because, you know, we're here in February right now. For me, from the UK, I'm here in a T-shirt. As a local, you got your coat on. But it can be 17 degrees in winter. So you had more and more British people starting to come. And very famously, on the front of Nice, there's a long walk called the Promenade des Anglais. And that was created for the British literally to be able to walk across the along the front, because there was nothing there before.
No, there was the sea and it was the dust, so it was very difficult for the British Research Institute to work. And so the Anglican priest decided to sponsor the Promenade des Anglais to let the British aristocracy to walk on the promenade, and so thanks also to the British aristocracy. Yeah. And
so now there's effectively been UNESCO recognition of that heritage of Nice. What's the actual expression in French?
In French is Nice ville de villégiature de la Riviera. So it's a Nice winter resort city. We got this inscription thanks to the 200 years of an incredible architecture that you find only here, and a landscape and gardens.
Yeah, well, I think it's so interesting that there is this celebration of Nice's position as a winter destination. Because, you know, from my experience of having come here just now, what a fantastic opportunity to come here, see the city, delve into its history, and then go skiing as well. So that's brilliant. Merci bien, Catherine.
Merci et heureuse de vous revoir.
So after Nice, I went to Isla 2000. I have to say, I was so impressed. There's obviously a clue in the name. It's high at 2,000 metres, has a great snow record. In fact, they're currently in the middle of their best season for 8 years. The resort is modern. Reminded me a lot of Flen. All the main apartments, shops and hotels are connected. It's very easy to keep your orientation, as you can pretty much see the resort wherever you are. It's a decent ski area, 120 kilometres apiece. Mainly blues and greens, brilliant for families, but there's some great skiing for good skiers. I was lucky enough to go out ski touring with a guide, Manon Innocenti, and oh my God, it was brilliant. We climbed for an hour and a half, and boom, a perfect pitch of untouched powder. It was so good. As soon as we got to the bottom, we went back up again. So for me, Isla 2000 ticks so many boxes. If you have young kids and you want a nice, safe place to learn to ski with a short transfer, then it works. And if you're a bit more experienced and you want to combine it with something different, then try it with a city break in Nice. And actually, I spoke to a few Brits who I met out there, and they said to me, please don't tell people about Isla. It's our secret. So sorry about that. Right, let's move from the Cote d'Azur to Scandinavia. We're lucky enough to be joined by an expert on the area today. Ben, you sound very British, but there's a clue in your surname, I think, Nyborg. Do you have family links with Scandinavia?
I do indeed. I have family based in Norway. So there's a strong connection there. And my wife is Swedish. So it's but both sides of the Scandinavian border. And a place that I've been traveling to my entire life. And it's home.
Evidently, you're very close to the Norwegian border. You skied over there yesterday. But we'll come to the resort itself shortly. I just wanted to ask you about how long you've been running the business Ski Scandinavia.
Yeah, we started in 2001 with our first guests arriving that year. And obviously, we're now celebrating 25 years in Scandinavia.
Fantastic. And I'm interested, you know, in that period of time. And I think the volume of skiers going from Britain to Scandinavia is relatively low. But there's a sense that Norway and Sweden are experiencing a surge in interest from British skiers. Have you seen that? I mean, evidently you've been in business for a long time, but have you seen an interest in more recent years?
I would say that's true. There's definitely more of an uptake for skiers and snowboarders looking for something different. The kind of holiday that you can get is very different to sort of the mainstream Alps experience, and that lends itself very well to skiers that want to just discover something a bit different. And what we found indeed is that so many come over to try the Scandinavian experience but actually enjoy it so much they come back year after year. So a lot of growth that we see is organic growth, word of mouth, as well as our own sort of advertising and marketing. But it's just becoming a place that people want to visit and visit again and again.
And you evidently cover Norway and Sweden. I'd like to focus on Sweden today. The last time you were on the show, we spoke more generally. But today I'd like to focus on the resort you're in at the moment. And I'm going to have another attempt at pronouncing it. Is it Stötten?
It's no SH at the front. It's just Stötten.
Stutton. Okay, Stutton. Now we know how it's pronounced. Could you tell us a little bit about the resort?
For sure. So Stutton was established in 1976. So they're actually celebrating their 50th anniversary this winter. So that's a big milestone for them. Lots of investment, obviously, over the years. In terms of the sort of the vibe of Stutton, it's a really Swedish resort. If you want to experience and ski like a Swede, the sort of quintessentially Swedish experience, then Stutton is 100% the place to go. I can describe it as sort of coming home. It's a destination where everyone is so friendly, whether it's other skiers, the lifters, the restaurants, everywhere you go, everyone is so welcoming. It really warms the heart. We've got customers here this week that have returned. They came last year for the first time and they just had to return again. There was just a no-brainer for them. They loved it so much. It's a feeling. Skiing here in Stutton is about the feeling it gives you. It's an incredible place. In terms of the sort of the layout of the resort, it's low level. So we're only at sort of our highest peak is only just under 400 meters. And it's sort of the vertical drop is literally from top to bottom is about the 400 meters. So it's not very high, which means it's incredibly safe. So for confidence building, for a relaxing time on the slopes where you're not sort of terrifying yourself. And of course, it's got the longest slope as well in the region, which is about 3 kilometers long. So overall, for a visitor coming to ski in Stutton in Sweden, it's just that very laid back vibe. And you actually go home from the ski holiday feeling uber relaxed.
Can I ask a couple of questions? A few thoughts have come to mind as you've been speaking there. I mean, firstly, we're talking today in the middle of half term week. And it struck me when I was looking around at Stutton before we spoke, that it does seem particularly good for families. You talk about the vertical drop not being overwhelming. The type of skiing that's on offer there, is it more suitable for beginners, lower intermediates?
I would say it's got a good range. It definitely lends itself to sort of beginners and intermediates. But having said that, there's some good range for some good treeline skiing for off-piste. It's very accessible using the lift system, so no need to hike. If there is a mixed ability group, so for example, maybe the children are beginners, mum prefers to stay on the piste and dad wants to push himself a bit harder, you've got the full range there. It will satisfy every single sort of level of skier.
To put it in context, what is the kind of size of the ski area?
So it is a compact ski area, which again, is a positive in the sense that you will always find your way home. But we're looking at about 50 slopes, again, catering for all levels from beginner to experienced skiers and snowboarders.
I guess one of the single biggest advantages of the resort is that it's an incredibly short transfer.
It is indeed. I mean, it's we say 25 minutes, but it's probably a bit shorter than that. So, yeah, it's incredible. Flying into the Scandinavian Mountains Airport, from there, it's a very, very quick hop and you're in the resort. And that's such a nice start to the holiday and also a nice end to the holiday as well, when you know you don't have a lengthy journey to get to the airport.
Yeah, for sure. And I think with, you know, families who've got young children, it kind of minimizes the are we there yet kind of question if you've only got like 20, 25 minutes to get through. You also mentioned, you know, only goes up to, let's say, about 800. And I say only because most people's frame for that is thinking about the Alps. But I think one of the things about Scandinavia and one of the reasons people have been going there is that even though it doesn't have that altitude that the Alps have, it has very reliable snow cover.
It does indeed. It's we say the snow is guaranteed here, and it is phenomenal. The temperatures being obviously further north. So if you look at it in terms of latitude, what it lacks in altitude, it makes up in latitude. So we're much further north. So the colder weather, the snow is guaranteed.
And I think another image that people have in their minds of Sweden is that it's a very expensive place to go. What kind of prices are we talking about?
So I'm sat here. I've actually got the menus laid out in front of me because I have to remind myself. Living in Sweden, we sort of take these things for granted. But in the ski resorts, just looking at the menu, and I've just taken just the classic Swedish meatball main dish dinner, very good standard and good quality, £17. And if you're going up to the sort of a steak or something a little bit more, a bit bigger in terms of substance, you're around the £25 mark. So in fact, it's a little bit of a misconception that the prices are astronomical. It's helped by exchange rate. At the moment, it's about 12 krona to the pound, as I checked this morning. So in fact, in terms of pricing, it's uber competitive. It's very good value.
Actually, what you're saying there, I've just come back. It was less, I would say, in Isla 2000. But after that, I went on to Mirabel and Courchevel. And, eating in mountain restaurants there and restaurants around there, the prices are similar, if not more expensive than that. So that's really interesting to hear. Talking about the food and everything, I've been told that if you go to Staten, you need to try the fika.
Absolutely. Fika is a way of life here in Sweden. It's probably one of the most important meals of the day, not breakfast. It would be definitely fika. It's a time when you can sit down, have a coffee or hot drink, and then just enjoy something very sweet. And just the, as we say in Sweden, the mysigt, it's just a cozy way to just relax, unwind, and enjoy something sweet to eat.
Do you want to just explain what it is?
So it's basically, fika is it's not a specific sweet dish or cake. It's really more the time you take to enjoy it. So you could have a fika with a cinnamon bun. You could have it with just a cheesecake. It doesn't really matter what it is. Fika is the time you take to actually enjoy that sweet indulgence.
Excellent. I must admit, I didn't realize that at all. And I really like that concept. It's maybe something along the lines of, is it the Danish concept of hygge?
It's very, very similar to the hygge kind of, the hygge type of attitude, let's say. Mysigt, yeah. I would say, is the Swedish equivalent. You would say to somebody, let's go and fika, which is to basically, go and sit down together, have a coffee and a cake.
That is brilliant, Ben. I really appreciate you sharing that. And hopefully that's given listeners a better understanding of Staten and how you actually say it. Hopefully I've got it right about the fifth time round. If it's okay with you, I'm going to move on to Alice now. Alice, our minds are very much on the Winter Olympic, but let's turn our thoughts to the Paralympic Winter Games, which start next month on the 6th of March. I believe you're going out to the Paralympics to promote your new unparalleled project. Listener, if you look in the show notes, you'll see how that's spelt slightly differently. We'll come on to the games later. But I read that you said the outdoor clothing industry has failed disabled people. It's time for something new. I wondered if you could tell us what the unparalleled project is.
Yeah, completely. Well, okay, 1.3 billion people globally are living with some kind of disability or chronic illness. And in the UK, that's nearly a quarter of the population. Yet outdoor clothing is not designed for many of the conditions and many of the limitations that we experience. As an inclusive accessibility designer in the sports and outdoor industry, it's very, very slow going. And I think this sector is still very much seen as a charity community, although it really, really isn't. I think the adaptive clothing market is now valued at over $15 billion and nobody's tapping into that market. I think I was really shocked when I started to look, I was doing a report for the Paralympics and looking at sit skiing, looking at adaptive skiing and understanding that across several demographics, the sport is becoming more and more popular. And especially now that our actual population demographic has switched from a pyramid into an obelisk, with all of our baby boomers now being far more active, living a lot longer, wanting to be out on the slopes for much longer, but having to deal with things like dexterity issues or hip replacements, knee replacements, but they still want to be getting out there. And so adaptive ski is offering this amazing way of people being able to access the sport in many different capacities, as well as obviously accessible tourism is on the up, huge up.
You mentioned that you've been working as a designer. What kind of work have you been doing up until now?
So most of the work that I've been doing, actually, I used to live in Sweden. I used to work for the H&M group out there designing kind of sportswear. Then I've worked with Adidas, with the All Blacks rugby team on the Olympics as well. And then I've worked in surfing, in scuba diving, in military, all kinds of different things. And then in 2015, I ended up hemiplegically paralyzed with a neurological disease called transverse myelitis. And so I've been in a 10-year recovery. And during that 10-year recovery, it has been incredibly difficult to carry on working in the industry, mostly because systemically it's not set up for people with disability to be actually be working in the industry, let alone actually designing. And so Unparalleled is, it's not a brand, it's not a clothing range. What it is a collective coming together from the community. So everyone from children and parents who are doing adaptive ski, right through to people who are just starting the sports and accessing them for the first time, right the way through to professional athletes and Paralympians, for us actually to start co-designing together different adaptations that actually make adaptive ski possible, because there's no clothing for it. And I don't know if you've ever tried to sit down in a really quite advanced sitting position when you're in a sit ski. If you tried sitting down in your salopettes and your ski jacket, well, you just can't. Most of your ski jacket ends up here. Your salopettes are wedging up. You know, it's completely impractical for most adaptive snow sports.
It's interesting. I watched a couple of your videos, I guess, on Instagram or something like that, where you're demonstrating how impractical a lot of the existing design is. So you're working with the Reaction Collective. I previously interviewed Heather Davis from Reaction Collective in episode 255. What role do they play in the Unparalleled project?
Huge role. I mean, their support has been immense. First off, I think just that their understanding of the need and the niche and the reasons why, that's kind of pivotal. But then also the collective is amazing. You know, projects where it takes me like 3 years to get it kind of signed off by a brand and start getting into development, we've done in 4 months. These are all amazing people within the sports and outdoor industry that have such invaluable skills, and they're all bringing that. And we are really are working in a collective effort, a more grassroots effort, I guess, really to show a blueprint of how the industry could be moving. And so the collective is also brilliant because we have such a strong network of makers and repairers, very talented makers and repairers in the outdoor industry. And so we are very quickly able to put these adaptations into prototyping, testing them like we were in the Alps recently. And it means that we are expediting that whole process that a brand would have to do.
If listeners haven't listened to that episode with Heather, the Reaction Collective is really about, well, I guess the long-term goal is probably minimizing carbon emissions, but it's improving and increasing the lifespan of garments. Mm-hmm. So in that context, a number of jackets have been donated and then shared or repurposed. Is that what's happened?
Yeah. So let's take yourself, for example. Imagine that you've got all your gear, you love your gear, and you have an accident tomorrow. And you think, do you know what? Instead of having to sit looking out the window at the slopes, I want to be getting out there, but my kit just isn't quite up to par. We would take your existing kit and we would actually start adapting your kit straight up. And we have, when we adapt, we can adapt for different situations. So Fee, who we've been adapting for, she sits skis, but she can kind of stand up and walk around. So this jacket adapts with her, whether she's standing or whether she's sitting down. So we would actually start working with your gear rather than you having to go, oh, great, I'm going to have to throw this away and get something else. We can adapt your gear straight up. And then, yes, we are inundated with ski wear. Like, there is more ski wear then there are people for the next six generations. We don't need new ski wear. We've got a very circular avenue that then caters to that quarter of the population that hasn't been catered to.
And you mentioned when you're in Courchevel, you're working on a film shoot. Could you explain what that's going to be for?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think because this is an area that a lot of people don't know exists. They don't understand. They don't understand how big the community is or how quickly the adaptive sports are growing. We have very much been making a documentary that kind of highlights different people's journeys with sit skiing, whether that is somebody who's entering it for the first time, whether that is kids, whether that is Paralympians, and the issues that everyone has in having to DIY their own gear. And so, yeah, we're creating a documentary all around this and around creating this open source solution base. Yeah, to really kind of highlight a new way of how we can go about things that is solution based.
And we mentioned before that you're going out to Italy to the Paralympic Games. Mm-hmm. What will you be doing while you're out there?
So we are actually going to be, I suppose, launching the initiative, launching the project. We're actually going to be in the Patagonia store in Milano on the 5th of March. It's a free event, so anyone in that area, please come along. So we're going to be showing a trailer for the documentary. We'll have lots of garments there that are adapted. We may even have a sit ski for you guys who are able-bodied to actually try out what it's like to sit down in all your gear. And we're going to have talks and refreshments, and it's going to be a really great space to bring the community together. We're also going to be doing a couple more in Cortina over the opening weekend, yet to be announced. So we're really going to be upping the conversation really around this. I mean, the whole of the Olympics talks about legacy, and what better legacy is there to talk about accessibility into alpine sports and into kind of climate and circularity?
The timing is clearly extremely good for that. So how can individuals, if they're listening to this now, support Unparalleled or get involved?
We have a website where you can actually sign up to start getting information. One of the things that we would really love is anyone involved in any part of adaptive sport to get in contact. You know, you might be an instructor, you might be the parent of, you might be somebody who wants to get into it, or somebody who's doing it at various levels, or has developed some really clever ways of getting around resorts that aren't accessible. We want to hear from the whole community, but we also want to hear from the able-bodied community, from the whole collective, as to kind of come and get engaged. We also obviously need to be funding this work. At the moment, it's not for profit, and we need to be funding this work. So we are obviously looking for funding. We're looking to engage the whole community. And if this is an area that you think, gosh, I know nothing about, we really want you to come and get engaged. I think one of the conversations around accessibility that isn't accessible is so many people are scared of getting the language wrong. They're scared of having getting, you know, the nuance of the conversation wrong. Or did I say that right? Should I call you disabled? And I think we just have to keep remembering that disabled really is, it's a social model that people are disabled by the way that we've designed society, culture, and civic places, resorts, clothing. That's what we're disabled by. And I think it's just really important that we just start having these conversations about how to make it more accessible for everybody.
Well, that is actually brilliantly summed up. At Listex last year, I moderated a panel that effectively was a DEI. And I did so much research beforehand to try and make sure I got my vocabulary correct. Because it is difficult if you're not involved in the area to know exactly what to say. But the principles, everything you're talking about there is excellent. I'm going to put some links into the show notes so that listeners can find out more. Really appreciate that. Super interesting. I look forward to hearing how it goes. On the subject of kit, last month, the SIGB, Snow Sports Industries of Great Britain, held their annual ski test in Champalouc. Here's a few stats. There are 113 individual testers, 53 brands, 614 skis, 181 pairs of boots, and our equipment guru Al Morgan was out there testing for Fall Line magazine. So let's hear his thoughts on the new kit coming next winter.
Hi Ian, I've just got back from the SIGB ski test, which took place in Champalouc in the Monte Rosa ski area of Italy from the 26th to the 29th of January. I'd normally send a report in from out there, but it was so busy this year I just did not have time. I've not actually been there before, and that area is amazing. It's truly stunning. It's got such a raw, natural beauty because of the rugged high mountain terrain. And I was really, really pleased to have some extra days out there to test some backcountry specific kit. I was out with Andy Townsend of Infinity Mountain Guide, who's Four Lines backcountry editor. He's also the dad of Fionn Townsend, who's the main female ski tester I work with. Talk about a talented ski family. But yeah, between Fionn and I, just to give you an idea, we got in 9 days, we got tested over 300 different bits of kit. So it was quite an intense week. The main test ran over 4 days. It was based at the top of the funicular from Fracherie at Champalouc. And actually, this was perfect. We had a high-speed chair, brilliant pisted terrain with off-piste just off the sides. So you could test pretty much every category. We also got some fresh snow on the way out, as well as about halfway through the week. And this was interspersed with sunny days, so it was pretty ideal. Testing wise, I was testing kit for you for the Ski Podcast, as well as for the Telegraph, and of course for Four Line Skiing Magazine. So I was testing with 8 others for that mag. We tested over 150 different skis, and that involves 2, 3, or even 4 people skiing on a ski. So that's a lot of laps just to get a proper handle on how the kit performs. And it wasn't just skis either. We were testing bindings, boots, socks, footbeds, clothing, helmets, goggles, backpacks, avalanche kit, basically everything and anything we could do and test regarding skiing. It's the most varied selection of kit that I've ever seen out at test, and it was absolutely superb. So a massive thank you to everybody that put in effort to get kit out there and to organise the test. So onto the exciting stuff. What's hot? Well, yeah, I'm not going to spoil all of next season, but boots wise, there's quite a lot going on. Salomon has really changed boot construction, I suppose, with their new S Pro Alpha C, which they've actually already released in limited quantities. And here they've removed the pivot on the inside, on the medial side. So you get real drive into this ski at the start of the turn. So this is a bit like giving power steering to intermediate and advanced level skiers. Atomic's releasing a rear entry boot called Nexus. And this was a real surprise. We're often a little nervous on our rear entry boots may ski, but this gave a really good skiing sensation as a fantastic liner. Head's been tweaking boots. They use dual boa on their new Calibre Pro boots, but instead of having one dial on the bottom of the boot and one on the cuff, both dials are on the cuff, so you can adjust the tension over the foot and over the leg from a very similar location. Scarpe has also put a dial in a similar location, but it only closes over the foot in their new F1 RS touring boot. All the other F1 boots are for pins only, but this will actually work in multi-norm and touring bindings because it is a touring norm boot. With Nico Schirmer, they've also developed a limited edition Quattro Pro, a boot which I adore, that Quattro Pro boot, but it's got a different colorway and some tweaks specific for his skiing. So that's pretty cool. There's loads more boot updates, which I'll not necessarily go into. So Skis, Black Crows has a new Vina core to sit alongside their Mirrors core. And we lovingly referred to this ski as the banana ski because it's pretty bright yellow and has a massive sweep at the tip and tail. They've also updated their Freebird touring skis, which are sensational. And I think the Camox is going to be a real hit. Head had an interesting test. They've got a new Discovery All Mountain ski, and it came serviced. Basically, it had no base bevel on the side edge, and it was just skied terribly at first, so it gave them a bit of a headache, but they sorted that. And that new Discovery ski, when it's serviced properly, is absolutely phenomenal. Rosie's got a load of new Hero products, so that's brilliant. And actually, you know, no surprise, given this is an Olympic year. And actually, what was brilliant, Zag, who have not been at test for many years, were out there. They've got a new lead ski designer that's come over from another major ski brand. And the new kit from Zag is very, very impressive. If anybody knows K2 Mindbender skis, they've got new constructions for next year. Again, just superb in an array of widths, and we absolutely love them. If people have listened to the podcast in the past, they'll know of the Nordica multi-pista skis. So that range has expanded, as well as Multigara. So fantastic pieced skis there. Armada has already done an early release of their antimatter skis, but at test was the first time that we used them, and they blew us away in the 92 and the 100 widths. I mean, they were just superb. Blizzard often makes really beefy performance punchy skis, and they've got a new canvas, which they claim is the least Blizzard, but actually it still has that brilliant feel, but it doesn't have the big, strong laminates that you see in some of their others, so it made it a really fun, versatile ski. And then Faction, their Dancer 79 that they had for this year, they've expanded that range, so they've changed what were the Dancer 1 and 2, so there's now an 89 and a 99, and they come in metal and non-metal laminate versions,
and they are absolutely brilliant. The bases look outstanding and they ski superbly well. So there's loads more I could talk about, and that's probably more than enough already, but we'll be covering a lot of it for next season. So much for a quick summary. So anyway, I hope that gets you and the listeners excited about what's to come. And I just wish everybody a fabulous rest of your winter. Thanks, Ian, and I'll see you soon.
So it's interesting, having just had that conversation with you, Alice, I wonder, with the trajectory that we're on, if you think that it's inevitable in due course that they'll be testing for adaptive equipment at these type of events.
There has to be. I mean, you know what's crazy is like having this conversation on another podcast yesterday. And so, yes, we really, really need to start taking this a lot more seriously.
And that is really interesting. Clearly, it's going to develop significantly as time passes. Incidentally, listener, if you're new to the show and you want to hear more from Al, we deep dive into the best new skis, ski boots, helmets, goggles, gloves and socks each autumn. So I'll put some link in the show notes and you can listen to some of our more recent episodes. Talking of episodes, if you've enjoyed this one or even if you didn't like it, I'd love to know. You can leave a comment on Spotify, Instagram or Facebook. Our handle is @theskipodcast, or drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of each podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. We've had one bit of feedback since the last episode. Glyn on YouTube said, "I really enjoyed your interview with Tim Wall." That was episode 299. "I discovered the ski lodge in its first year, stayed in Litania for the last 27 years, including many full seasons. Got to know Tim and Debbie pretty well. Wonderful people and hosts." Thanks for that, Glyn. There are now 303 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. And I had a look at stats. 201 of those were listened to in the last week alone. So if you would like to get some insight into a particular destination, listen to an interview with an athlete, or find out about the latest kit, just go to skipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to listen to. I can also tell you in the last week, the majority of our listeners were in the UK, about 20% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Singapore, Argentina, and Egypt. If you'd like to help the podcast, there are three things you can do. Follow us or subscribe. You can give us a review on Apple Podcasts or leave a comment on Spotify. And if you're booking ski hire this winter, don't forget, you can get an additional discount if you use the code SKIPODCAST when you book at InSportRent.com. I'll put a link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. Right. I'd like to thank my guests for today. Alice, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. It's been really great to have this conversation. Thank you.
Excellent. And Ben, thank you.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
I would like to thank Tyrol for sponsoring the podcast. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.